Hello and welcome to the Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. I've been working in press boxes up and down the country for over 20 years, reporting and commentating on football. And I meet some wonderful people in every press box that I work in who all have very different stories to tell about the journeys they've been on to get where they are, whether it's radio or television, which is an avenue I've never particularly gone down. There are 20 episodes, so we've reached the key of the door with this one, episode 21. But where you found this episode, you'll find all the previous 20, including the first one with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker, all up to our most recent episodes with the likes of John Murray and Ian Dark and various others. Let me introduce my two guests for the Commentator's Curse. For this episode, my first guest is a Radio 5 Live stalwart who built up his career not too far where I am these days in the West Country, in Bristol. He's now a regular on 5 Live commentating. Also, not just football, but he's a regular on golf commentaries and can be heard during Ryder Cup stuff. And he's an advocate of the Fantasy Premier League podcast, which must consume more of his time than is frankly healthy. Alistair Bruce Ball is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Yeah. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Ian. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. An unhealthy amount of time spent on fantasy football. I mean, I always spent quite a bit of time on it as a hobby, as an activity anyway, before doing our podcast. We started our Fantasy 606 podcast. So that's with me, Chris Sutton and Statman Dave. I think we're into our fourth season of doing it now. But since I've got into doing the pod, I really have sort of discovered this whole world of fantasy football managers, you know, on YouTube and via podcasts, and people who make a living out of the game effectively. And so it means that I now understand the strategy of it a lot better. And it now means, yes, you're right, I waste a hell of a lot of time in team selection.
I will get into the nuts and bolts of that as we go on, Ali, if you don't mind. My other guest who's with us today on the Commentator's Curse is a man you can hear every weekend commentating on EFL matches, which turn up on the ITV4 highlight show. But it's for the world feed, so it goes right around the globe. He previously was a match commentator for BBC Radio Sheffield, and he still works up in Sheffield for Sheffield United TV as and when it is required. Paul Walker is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Dan. You okay?
Yes, very good. Thank you. Do you indulge in fantasy football?
Absolutely not. I've tried it in the past. I pick a team and then a few weeks go by, I forget to take players out, put players in, and I find myself way down the pecking order. So, no, far too busy for all of that nonsense.
I'm with you on that, Ali. I mean, obviously, you're not exactly preaching to the converted here, but no. I'm the same. There is a certain degree of devotion and dedication.
Yeah. Do you know what's quite interesting, though, I think, Dance, about it, is that because we now do the podcast, I will occasionally mention the podcast to plug the pod during a football commentary. And what I find fascinating about that is it is such a Marmite subject, fantasy football, because it is a growing industry. You know, there are, and particularly with the younger audience, you know, particularly with the sort of younger generation of football fans, it's a way into football for them. So it's a good thing, actually, to, you know, for, I think, for us, the BBC, to be involved in, but for me personally to kind of be involved in, to sort of keep touch with that side of things. But the reaction you get when you mention it is very split. So people who think complete waste of time, absolute joke, don't even bother mentioning it in a football commentary. But I do know, like I was doing Fulham Arsenal yesterday, Arsenal finished with a clean sheet and Gabriel scores a header. I know straight away that's 14 points for managers who picked him. And I know I've got listeners listening who are thinking along those lines. So it's kind of, you know, you're a little bit damned if you do and damned if you don't. I've always enjoyed playing it and I love doing the pod.
As long as it doesn't ruin your weekend, that's what it seems to do for a lot of people that play this game. And for doing what me and Paul often did, you completely forget your responsibilities. Yeah. And by the time the game's kicked off, oh, I didn't put Drogba back in. And next thing you know, he scored a hat-trick. And your weekend is ruined. Birmingham City could win 7-0. And my weekend could still be ruined by not recalling somebody who gets a hat-trick. It's ridiculous. But I mean, as you say, it's a successful arm of what you do, Ali. It's become part of you.
It's a funny one as well, Ian, because it was a very unlikely idea that came into creation, because Chris Sutton and I worked together sort of properly for the first time for any length of time at the World Cup in Russia in 2018. Had a great time, got on well, came back, started doing the 606 phone-in together, and they wanted to find another another platform for us, something, you know, something else we could kind of work on. I wrote an email with about seven or eight different ideas, the last of which was an absolute throwaway line. Point eight, you know, in the sort of bulletin order was, I quite enjoy a bit of fantasy football. Listeners might enjoy it. Let's get Chris involved. I'm sure he's never played it. Chris's response to that was short and not very sweet. He said, I absolutely hate fantasy football. You will never get me playing that game. Four seasons on, here we are.
Well, you sucked him into this freakish world, and he's into it now, I presume.
Well, he is. I mean, he's a sort of anti-hero in a way to the fantasy football community, because he calls them all nerds. He makes very sort of left field differential decisions. So obviously, this season it's all about Erling Haaland, Captain Erling Haaland. He won't have that. He just won't be told what to do. On our pod, actually, Ian, they're known as Clough and Taylor. So Chris doesn't actually have the technical expertise to work the app to pick his own team. So he's got to get one of his sons to do that. So Chris is Clough and his son Ollie is Taylor. and at the moment, they're leading. So for the last few seasons, because they make these wacky and wild decisions, they don't do as well as some of us who are a bit more boring and template. But actually this season, they're taking it a bit more seriously and he's got a chance of winning the title. And I think our listeners are quite enjoying that, actually.
Yeah, he's a conflicted mind, I should imagine, Mr. Sutton. Paul, one thing you do that's slightly different to a lot of the guests I've already spoken to is you work for the Sheffield United TV station. Now, there are some obvious. I mean, Liverpool TV, Manchester United TV, Chelsea TV. Of course, they're the behemoths, I guess, of football in-house media. But you know, when you go down the pyramid. You look at Derby County and Charlton in League One, very, very strong on their in-house TV. And Sheffield United have always been very strong on that. How big an operation is it?
It is relatively, I would say. I mean, I go into the studio at Bramall Lane. It's a great position, actually, overlooking the pitch. There's me. There's a commentator who actually works for the club, Matt Young. There are two tech ops, if you like, and then usually two guests alongside me. So for the club, it's a fairly sizable operation. Their viewing figures are pretty good. They're happy with those. But for me, it's just a break from the norm, really. It gives me an opportunity to do something different. Also gives me an opportunity to watch the Blades, and I'm probably going to get outed on this podcast as being a Sheffield United fan. But hey, to heck with it. I left BBC Sheffield in 2014, so I can say it now. I am a Blade, and I just wait for all the Sheffield Wednesday fans coming for me on Twitter. So it gives me an opportunity to go and watch the Blades as well. It's nice and relaxed. And for the most part this season, it's been going very well up until recently, even though we're still second. But it's a different way of operating as well, because you're working for the club. You can't be as critical as perhaps you might be if you're working for somebody else. So you've got to bear that in mind. But no, on the whole, it's enjoyable. The lads down there are very helpful. The backroom team are very supportive. And it's just nice. It's just different. You know, when you're schlepping up and down the country on every weekend, just to be able to pop down to Bramall Lane, which is 15 minutes away from where I live, and do something like that. Nice. I enjoy it.
Do you find yourself stopping short of saying things at times? The self-edit mode kicks in more often than
you've got to be aware of who your paymasters are. And, you know, that kind of goes against what I've always kind of stood for and how I've operated in the past. But I get it. You know, you've got to kind of lean towards the club and try and take out the positives. But there are occasions where you have to say it as you see it. And recently it's not been good. And you can't pull the wool over people's eyes. You've got to do it in a sensible way. You can't go two-footed on the manager and certain players, but there is a way of doing it. You do it with balance, and you try and approach it from a good place as well. But it is different. It is a different way of working. And like you say, you are self-editing all the time. And there's been a couple of occasions this season where I thought, not sure whether I should have said that. Hope it doesn't come back on me. And, you know, it hasn't, but you do have to be very, very self-aware when doing it.
I've spoken to people, I mean, pundits actually more than people like us as commentators. Stuart Robson and Perry Groves have got into hot water working for Arsenal TV.
Yeah.
Sort of had their services sort of suspended for being too anti-Arsenal. Not quite the Arsenal fan TV levels of criticism. But yeah, treading that line, I don't know. And of course, as a national broadcaster, now both of you, there's no line that you can safely tread because the accusations of bias, as you've already intimated there, Paul, are always there, always there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll go back to the, we'll go back to your respective starts and how your career journeys progressed, because I believe, Ali, first with you, your own mother was a big a big sort of spark to doing what you do now.
Here we go. I'm strapping myself in for this one.
No. Dance, I have to say that is top research. That is top research. Very well done. But no, do you know what? And I've scribbled a few notes down here today because I just didn't want to possibly forget to mention a few things, and particularly certain people. I'm never going to forget my mum. But honestly, every single day, Dan, you know, I've done this job now for, you know, I started in BBC local radio in late 90s. So what is that? You know, we're coming on for sort of quarter of a century doing it. And every single day, I thank her for sort of spotting that she felt it might be a career for me and set me off on this path. And particularly when I'm at some of the events we get to go and cover, because, you know, had she not sort of said what she said at the time. So this is basically, so as a kid, Ian, I was massively into my sport and all sport, and certainly consumed sport, you know, loved my sort of grandstand on a Saturday afternoon and, you know, on the radio as well, and World of Sport and Dickie Davis and ITV and all of that. And also loved performing, you know, enjoyed talking, probably enjoyed showing off, but enjoyed doing school plays and stuff like that. So I can sort of finally see how the two things have kind of meshed together. But as I left university, so I did a degree at university in Italian and drama, which has absolutely nothing, or very little, I would say, to do with what we do now. Though occasionally the Italian, you know.
Yeah.
Can come in useful.
Of course. And the drama, let's face it.
And the drama. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, basically. 6 months to go. A lot of my mates knew exactly where they were heading, whether it was, you know, off to London to work in the city or advertising, whatever. I didn't fancy any of that. I really didn't. And it was my mum who said to me at that time, she said, well, how about a career in broadcasting or in journalism, in sports journalism? And genuinely, honestly, to that point, I'd not really considered it as a career, even though I'd sort of consumed it and loved it. And it was like a light bulb. I just thought, wow, if I put my mind to that and can actually make it happen, I could get paid for watching sport. That just seems like an absolute dream to me. And it was my mum who set me off on the path. And obviously it was a long way to go after that, because the thing I hadn't done by that point was get any work experience on the CV. So I'd not worked in student radio. I'd not done any work experience out of school time or university time. So it then set me back another sort of year, gathering all that together on the CV to then get myself to Cardiff. I went to Cardiff and did a postgraduate diploma in broadcast journalism there. And that's what eventually got me into local radio.
Where were you living then when you were growing up? Which part of the country were you in?
I grew up in Cambridge.
Right.
Grew up in Cambridge, Ipswich Town fan. I'm allowed to say that because I very rarely get to watch them or commentate on them now. Although quite a few years back, we did have a commentary where Mike Sewell, in brackets Norwich fan.
Oh, good old Mike.
Alistair Bruce Ball, in brackets Ipswich fan, with Brian Hamilton, who had a foot in both camps, did a few commentaries on Ipswich Norwich.
Oh, fantastic.
And so that definitely tested the old impartiality.
That's great.
But we've had a terrible record against them in recent years, so I've been well out of that.
Actually, that's really different, because normally when you've got a Blues Villa derby like I was used to, it's one commentator with a pundit from each side. Not a commentator, with a commentator from each side.
Right.
And poor Brian Hamilton in the middle, fending you both off. That's great. That must have worked really well. That must have worked really well, actually.
Yeah, it was good fun. And the one I remember where I think probably I didn't go over the top, because, you know, any goal, you know, in a big game you're going to get excited about. But I do remember Darren Bent sticking a third in at Portman Road, where I possibly was out of the seat and punching the air. But no one sees that, do they, kind of, as you're commentating on radio? It's probably a little bit naughty, that, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, we the professional mask has slipped on a couple of occasions for my good self, of Afemi Martins being top of the list. But moving swiftly on, Paul, you're a proper South Yorkshire lad. You mentioned we've outed you as a blade, or well, you've outed yourself, really.
But I'm gonna regret that.
Was it your mum, your uncle Derek, or the cat? What got you? What got you on the road to getting into broadcasting and journalism?
I enjoyed school. I can't say it was brilliant academically. University was never really on the cards. I stayed on and did sixth form purely because I had no clue what I was going to do. So I thought, well, that gives me a 2-year window to try and figure out what it is I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I knew I had an interest in sports broadcasting slash journalism, but I also wanted to be a traffic cop for the police. And I went down to an open evening in Sheffield with a mate of mine, and it was all going great. And I thought, oh, this is definitely for me. I'm loving all of this. Until it got to the part where they said how fit you had to be. And I just thought, I can't do that. This sounds like, you know, army drills and all of that kind of thing. So that I turned my back on that. That was it. That was the end of that interest. So I thought I'll pursue the interest in sports broadcasting. So I decided to get in touch with Hallam FM, which is the commercial station in Sheffield, who at that point, like all commercial stations, really, they had football rights sewn up. They were the ones. They were the leaders. So after numerous phone calls to the sports editor, Steve Banyard, who you may or may not know, you'll have seen him around on the circuit maybe, he gave in and said, yeah, come in on a Saturday and see how it all works. And that's exactly what I did. And I know you've had other people on this podcast who've kind of gone down a similar route, but, you know, I literally did start making the tea and taking scores off teletext, running them through to the studio, taking in the IRN reports on the carts again, rushing them through to the studio. And it slowly snowballed to the point where I got asked to drive the desk, which was always a scary experience with Steve on the other end. He was a perfectionist, an ultimate perfectionist. He was hard. He was really hard, a damn good commentator, but he was hard. And we used to have a debrief after every program. So the program would finish at 6. We'd all be back in the newsroom. I'd have my finger over the talk back button. And he would go through literally every minute of the Saturday afternoon show. What happened at 2:08? That wasn't good enough. 2:45, where was that? 2:55, you didn't fire the right bed. What happened at halftime? How come the sports news, you didn't lead with this and you led with that instead? Oh, it was horrendous. And we could be there till 7:30 at times. And at one stage, Dan Walker was helping out behind the scenes. So I was kind of in charge of Dan Walker, which, you know, incredible to think really at the time. But we were all kind of young lads who just wanted to go out on a Saturday night, get the experience at Hallam FM, go out. But we could be there till 7-8 o'clock at night, some of us, just listening to Steve go through the program and where it went right and where it went wrong. But no, it was a terrific experience. And then he said, oh, I want you to cover the ice hockey. I was like, ice hockey? I've got no idea about ice hockey whatsoever. He said, no, I don't want you to commentate on it. We're going to do a feature every week. All you need to do is take a ewer down to the Sheffield Arena and the coach will front the piece. Right, okay. So back then it was Alex Dampier, I think it was. So he grabbed the mic off me. I'd literally stand there with a ewer over the shoulder and he would say, hi, this is Alex Dampier of the Sheffield Steelers. We're getting ready for 5 flyers this weekend. With me, I've got a couple of players here. Chat, 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 chat. I'd record it all and take it back to the studio. And that went on for a couple of years, I think, to the point where I used to take the ewer in my school bag to school and at lunchtime go down to Queen's Road where they practice, get the feature, go back to school on the bus, then get 2 buses after school across Sheffield to dump the tape off and then get 2 buses back across Sheffield to get home again. And I did that for a tenner. And you know, but it was great. And you know, the longer it went on, to fast forward quite a bit, Steve, out of nowhere, got dismissed one afternoon. And I was told, you're now sports editor.
Right. At what age?
Early 20s, 21, 22, maybe, something like that.
This is quite similar to Steve Bauer, yeah, who was on a recent episode.
You said you're sports editor, the program controller at the time, and you're doing the game tomorrow, which was Arsenal-Sheffield United, which, if you recall, I think it was, what year would it have been? 98, 99, maybe?
Okay.
Steve Bruce was manager of Sheffield United. We played Arsenal and you might recall the ball was kicked out. I think we had an injury. And then the ball was thrown back in towards our goalkeeper. Kanu obviously didn't know what the protocol was, ran through and scored. Steve Bruce took our lot off. Arsene Wenger, very sportingly, said afterwards, we'll replay the game. I did the replayed game at Highbury, having never done a second's worth of commentary ever. And it was woeful. I was cacking it all the way down. It was just horrific, absolutely horrific. But the bosses said, no, you'll get better, you'll get better. So I was doing that. I was doing Sheffield Wednesday in the Premier League, which, you know, for all Wednesday fans will feel like a lifetime ago. And I was earning 13 grand a year, Dance. £13,000 a year. Even back then, that's pittance. And I didn't even get a company car. I didn't get the car that Steve was using previously. I'd used the pool car, which I think was a Ford Escort, I think it was at the time.
Quality. Top quality. Thumping up and down the M1.
That first commentary, honestly, believe me, I'd never want to hear it back. I'm glad it's been lost somewhere.
I think I'd be similar, Paul, because, and I actually have a very similar tale in a way in terms of being dropped in it, but it was actually a sort of managerial strategy. So the guy who was my boss when I eventually got into the sports team at BBC Radio Bristol is a guy who's still there now called Jeff Twentyman, who I'm sure you will have come across lots of people listening will know, had a very good footballing career himself, was an absolutely fantastic boss for me. I mean, really, really thought I think he had a lot of faith in kind of what I could do before I realized that I could do it. He was always sort of, you know, pushing you and cajoling you and encouraging you and, you know, just really, really inspirational, actually. I'm just on a tangent, fabulous about this job. I was at Ashton Gate last week doing the FA Cup game between Bristol City and Manchester City, and Jeff's there and I'm there and we're working, you know, side by side again for the first time. It was, you know, that's just marvelous. That is one of the marvelous things about this job. But he obviously felt that I could do football commentary. And I think I was sort of heading towards that way, thinking, yeah, I could give this a go. But at that time, I wasn't doing it. And we would have the occasional game of golf together away from work. And one Thursday afternoon, we're playing golf together. And we've played a couple of holes. And I'm standing over a 6-foot putt or whatever to try and halve a hole. And he just said to me, he said, by the way, you're doing Rovers Notts County on Saturday. And that's the first time, you know, I knew I was going to be doing a football commentary. So it gave me just enough time to sort of prep and get ready, but not enough time, like 2 or 3 weeks, to panic about it and build it up into something that it never was.
Yeah, but did you miss the putt?
I can't remember, Dan. I can't remember. But I just look back on that and I think what a clever little bit of management that was, in terms of it just relaxed me. It totally relaxed me about going into the game. Like Paul, I think I made an absolute, you know, arse of it, really, to be honest. But, you know. But it got me started anyway.
That I had a very similar tale, although at BRNB and Capital Gold, although my first game, I wasn't commentating on air, I was commentating off air. But much like you, Ali, I had about 48 hours notice because Tom Ross had a whiteboard in his office, which was divided into 14 sections with tape. And it was the next 2 weeks' worth of fixtures, and all written out in marker pen, different colours marker pen, very OCD. In green were the initials of the reporter or commentator going to it. And then I just happened to walk past his office one Thursday, having done my flying eye stint, and just looked at, and next to Walsall Chesterfield, it said ID. And I just carried on walking. ID. There's nobody else who works here with the same initials as me. What's going on? And that was when going in to see Tom and knocking on the door, and he just said, yep, you're doing it. And that was that, you know. So he didn't have that horrible lead up of time. So I only had a day to panic instead of, as you say, Ali, a week. Exactly. Yeah. But you are frustrated.
I had 24 hours.
24 hours, of course, before that Arsenal game.
Yeah. Never been to Highbury before. Didn't know how anything worked. Nothing.
No.
We didn't have ex-players. This is quite strange looking back now, but it felt completely normal at the time. We didn't have ex-players or ex-managers as summarizers. We had dedicated reporters who would then switch to become summarizers when their game got picked as the main game. So I did it with a chap called Peter Jenkins, who was the Sheffield United reporter and had been for years. Lovely fella. And he really looked after me that day. But I can't imagine doing a game now like that with a co-commentator who's just similar to me. Really,
I think there are still radio stations. WM in the BBC Radio WM. I think Daz Hale will do games with a Mike Taylor, something like that. I want to get those guys on at some point on this pod, you know, to find out about that very dynamic of which you speak, Paul, because it is a very different dynamic.
Wouldn't feel comfortable doing that, being a summariser. I had a couple of stints at doing it. John Bradley, who, again, you may well know from, he was Viking FM back then. So he was kind of my compatriot. And he phoned me and said, look, I'm doing a game at Wembley tomorrow, Grimsby against Northampton, and it might have been a playoff final, can't really remember. Come and summarise for me at Wembley. I was like, what? Come and summarise. It'll be a laugh. It'll be a laugh. He's a bit of a lad, is John. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
So I went down and I summarised on Grimsby against Northampton in a playoff final. I'm pretty sure it was a playoff final. Forgive me.
Would it be the one where John Frayne scored a free kick in the last
quite
minute?
Possibly was. Yeah. Was that a playoff final? It wasn't a.
It was a playoff final. Yes. John like Frayne. Yeah.
So I was there summarising on two teams I've never seen. Don't really have any right to be there. And John just says, oh, here's my mate from Sheffield. Knows a bit about football. He's going to join me for the game today. It's like, what am I doing here? So, yeah, I can't imagine. I can't imagine doing that on a regular basis. Especially and of course, today as well. And the way that the world is today.
And we should remind some of our younger listeners that for Paul going to Highbury, for example, or for you, Ali, doing Bristol Rovers, Notts County, the myriad of websites and apps that can help commentators prepare nowadays simply did not exist.
No, that's true.
Maybe Soccer Base was in its infancy as a reference point. That's probably about it, isn't it? Apart from getting the old Rothman's textbook out. That was pretty much all we had, wasn't it, Ali?
I think that's right. It's funny, you know, I speak to a lot of younger commentators coming through now and people who want to do this job. And that's one of the points I would make to them is that there is a wealth of material out there now that you can really get seriously well prepared for a football commentary. But I still don't think there's a substitute for, you know, let's say you're going to go and see a team in the FA Cup that you've not seen. So I'm not talking maybe Premier League teams that we see week in, week out and everyone knows about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whoever it is, say Exeter City or wherever, just to pluck a name out of thin air. But just to call up the local newspaper, the local journalist, you know, the press officer at the club, chat to them, talk, yeah. if they've got time to get the little nuggets of information, not necessarily stats and age and goals and caps.
It's but stories, just Ali, isn't it? Little stories behind stories. The players. Absolutely, mate.
That you can then thread into a commentary and it makes it, you're not pretending that you've followed this club for years and years and years, but I think it just shows to your listener that you've taken the time and you've bothered to find out a bit about the club. And you can even credit the people that you spoke to in the commentary while you do it. I just think it massively adds to it.
100%.
Exactly right. And those moments in a press box when you first arrived or the press room where you see the head of media or something who you've not seen for a while. Like when I was at Reading last week, Paul, I saw Kev, the head of Sheffield United media. Always good to see
him. You can't miss him.
No, you can't miss
him. He won't mind me saying that either.
He's
a big lad.
He's a big lad, but he's also a big
help. Brilliant.
He's also a big help. He will give you any nuggets of information that he thinks you may not necessarily be aware of.
Yeah.
And it's graciously accepted because, as Peter Drury once said to me, you need to be the person inside that stadium with the most knowledge of the game. You need to know more about that game than anybody else when you walk in as a commentator. And I get that completely. Mm. But that, however much you've loaded your brain up with stats, that there's always a little overspill that can be added to by a head of media or a local journo, as Ali says, or just a fan or somebody you've bumped into who can, you know, give you some nugget. Because funny enough, the fans' vibe that you get as you walk up to a commentary position can inform your introduction. Because I was at Tottenham on Saturday. You have to walk through that concourse to get to where you walk up to your press seat. And I happened to be walking through just as the full-time whistle went at Bournemouth. And I was expecting a riotous reception, but it was kind of a muted cheer to Bournemouth beating Liverpool and meaning Spurs would be fourth no matter what. I was expecting something, you know, and that informed my introduction. I thought, well, I was waiting for a bit more oomph. And it wasn't quite there. But those moments inside a ground before the microphone's even been switched on, there are so many things, aren't there, that you can glean and utilize in your commentary to the betterment of that commentary, without question. Ali, let me move back to you because you've had that break where during a game of golf you're thrust into Bristol Rovers, Notts County.
I think it was, yeah.
So how long did it stay on that plane when you were, you know, doing that and then the next, I don't know, whatever you might consider the next level up?
Yeah, I mean, I actually dance. I would love to have stayed at BBC Radio Bristol for longer than I did. So I sort of started full-time commentary probably in about 1998. And what we did, what Jeff Twentyman decided was, whereas previously you'd had a Bristol Rovers commentator who would just do Bristol Rovers all season, a guy called Mike Kay, and then Phil Tottle used to do Bristol City. But then Alistair Durden, who's a fantastic football commentator, although doesn't do much commentary, if any commentary at all now, has actually gone into television and more, you know, presenting side of things.
Yeah.
He and I sort of took over as the main two commentators, but Jeff decided to break it up that we would do half City and half Rovers. And a bit like Paul is saying, you know, working in a city like Sheffield, I actually think it was a good way to go, because you just got accused by both sets of fans, basically, of either, you know, of being biased against whichever one it was that they didn't like. But I think they could see that actually we were quite balanced, rather than being just the Bristol City guy or the Bristol Rovers guy. I actually quite liked also being across both stories properly and seeing both managers equally, rather than just seeing, you know, being attached to one club. So did that through until 2001. My wife had got a job in London about a year before me, and she moved to London. And it was always my aim. I always sort of, you know, had a dream of working for Five Live. And a job came up in 2001, not as a football commentator, just as a broadcast journalist, just to get into the sort of sports newsroom, basically, and become a sports reporter. And I went for that and was lucky enough to get that job. And so took that in 2001. So my time, you know, doing commentary on City and Rovers and Yeovil and Gloucestershire, County Cricket Club and Somerset was relatively brief, actually, but I absolutely loved it.
Fair to say that Bristol City are probably, with the exception maybe of Preston North End, the biggest club never to have played in the Premier League?
Yeah, I think so, Dancer. When I was back there, I mean, Ashton Gate now, what a venue, you know, what a setup, you know, they've got. And as a city, for a city the size of Bristol, it's the constant, you know, talking point in the city, you know, not to have a top division football club is a great shame. It's no less passionate for that. And actually, the thing I think, I mean, Paul could probably speak to this as well, but the thing I really benefited from Bristol City not being in the top division, nor Bristol Rovers, was the access you got to the players and the manager and the fans, and how easy it was to operate as a journalist compared maybe to working at a top flight club, where it's, you know, just getting that access and having those relationships is a lot more difficult because you're kept at arm's length. I mean, you know, at Bristol City, half an hour before kickoff, you'd be in the manager's office with Danny Wilson talking through the team, and you'd sprint off up to the commentary point, and then you'd send down your interview. Great fun with Ian Holloway in the early days at Bristol Rovers. I mean, what a baptism of fire for a young radio reporter that was. But just that access, I think, really, really prepared me, really gave me a great grounding for doing, you know, post-match interviews and that sort of thing at a more elevated level, if we want to call it that, in terms of, you know, clubs being higher up the leagues. But coming into it off the back of having fantastic access and lots of amazing experiences, good and bad, to get you ready for it.
Mm.
Paul, I mean, you concur with those?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to rewind a little bit to what I was talking about before, I was at Hallam FM sports editor for all of 4 months, I think it was, because I got word that commercial radio was pulling out of doing football. But I was aware that there was a job going at BBC Sheffield. However, I'd missed the deadline to apply for the job. And David Burns, great bloke, who's now at BBC Humberside, was sports editor at BBC Sheffield then. And obviously, we crossed paths doing presses and stuff like that. So he said, apply for the job. I said, Burnsy, it's too late. I've missed it. I've missed the boat. He said, leave it with me. I'll try and make sure that they give you a bit of extra time to get your application in. I like what you do. Personally, I'd like you to come and work for me. So it did that. I went for the interview, got the job. So I worked under Burnsy for a while until he decided he was going to go back to BBC Humberside, where he'd initially started. And I ended up being sports editor after Luke Wildman. Luke Wildman was next in line. He became sports editor. Luke left for Canada. I became sports editor at BBC Sheffield, left in 2014. But great times there. I mean, Ali spoke about some of the managers. I'm just looking down here at a list of a few. Warnock obviously was one that I dealt with for 7 years. Some of the best times ever. The 2002-03 season when they got to two cup semi-finals and the playoff final was just probably still the best. And he was great for access. He's always up for doing stuff. In fact, going back to Highbury, I don't know what it is about Highbury. We were playing in the FA Cup at Highbury. And the day before, I'd gone to interview him. And he said, are you doing our game tomorrow? I said, yeah, how are you getting down? I said, well, I'll just drive down in the morning. Oh, no, you're not doing that. You're coming down with us, son. You're coming down with us. So he picked up the phone, literally mid-interview, rang his secretary, Donna, and said, Donna, can you sort an extra room at the hotel for us for Paul Walker? Yeah. And they were staying at Sopwell House, which I think is the England team hotel, or at least it used to be. He said, you come down with us tomorrow. So I was like, wow, excellent. Going down on the team bus and everything. This is going to be incredible. Turned up in the car park. Sure enough, the coach is there. The players are arriving in the cars. They're all getting on the coach. I'm stood by the coach. Neil eventually arrives. What are you doing, son? I said, well, I'm coming down with you, aren't I? No, you're going down with Sharon, my wife. You're going down with Sharon and the kids. So I travel down behind the team coach with Sharon, bless her, who's lovely, and I still speak to her to this day, driving down with William and Amy. I don't know how old they are now, in the back seat. And we're chatting about all things football and his private life and how they met, blah, 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 which I can't go into because I would get into trouble for that. So I travel down with her to the hotel, which I just thought was incredible. There I was thinking I'm going down with the players and I can sit at the back of the bus and maybe play cards. I got all these ideas in my head about what's going to happen. And I went down with Warnock's missus. I did come back on the team coach though. So I lived the dream after the game and we drew. We took it to a replay.
It's funny though, Dance, talking about those relationships that you develop because of the sort of, like I say, the access you had and how close you could get. I always remember, I think it's probably one not the hardest bits of broadcasting, but to go and ask a player to come and speak to us after a devastating defeat, the one that still sticks with me to this day, I'm probably not going to get the season right now. It's Ian Holloway's Bristol Rovers team that were top of League One with 10 games to go, and they eventually lost at Cardiff. We did commentary on them at Cardiff. They lost at Cardiff on the final day of the season to slip out of the playoff places. So they were thinking automatic. They didn't even get playoffs. It was a devastating, devastating collapse for them. And a really, a good group of players and a lovely group of players. It was the likes of Jason Roberts and Jamie Cureton and Nathan Ellington and, you know, and all those sort of guys and Trevor Chalice. And Andy Tilson was the centre-back at that team. It was a lovely, lovely chap. Was always good as gold to deal with. And Jeff was presenting and he said, you know, we've got to try and go and see if we can get some reaction to this. And, you know, I asked everyone, almost didn't want to ask. And, you know, you think, don't you? You try and put yourself in the player's shoes. And, you know, I was kind of always taught whatever the result that you get your head up and you do speak whichever way. But it was they were crushed. And Andy Tilson eventually was the last out and said he'd come and do it and gave us an interview, sort of last few minutes of a show we did that day with tears in his eyes. It was really moving. And it was one where you almost felt bad about kind of asking the question. But at the same time, the fans would have been disappointed, but they would have also wanted to hear from him, which they did. And I credit him massively for coming to do it. But it's when, you know, we always talk, don't we, about you don't want to get too close. And Paul was talking right at the start of our chat about, you know, when you're, I mean, we were commentating for BBC Radio. We weren't commentating for the club. But that you know, that thing where the line can sometimes get a little bit blurred.
Sure.
It was really moving, actually, really moving.
Well, something vaguely similar for me in the World Cup in Brazil, because I was the England correspondent for TalkSport at that tournament. So I'd fostered a relatively okay relationship with some of the players prior to the tournament, because I've been the correspondent for a few months. But after the defeat to Uruguay in Sao Paulo, I had to go down to the mix zone and get, because we knew England were out, didn't we? I think it was confirmed the next day when Costa Rica and Italy played, but I think we knew that England were already going home. And there were one or two players that did front up. Joe Hart was the one that springs to mind from what you've just been talking about there, Ali, because Joe Hart came out to speak to me and a couple of others, English reporter. There must have been somebody there for Five Live as well, but he was in tears. You could see he'd... You could still see the tear streaked face before he'd come out to front up. But you're correct. You can't toss underarm deliveries at these guys. You've got to ask the questions that the fans would want answering. Mm. And I will, to this day, credit Joe Hart for not shirking a single thing that any of us, not just me, but any of the journalists that were stood around in that little cluster, put to him that evening, when you can see how badly he's taken, knowing that his World Cup is over two games in. But yeah, unfortunately, that's the nature of journalism. But there's a way of phrasing the question as well, right? I mean, you know, there's some people that can go in there with a rubber trident and some that go in there with a steel trident. And we know the difference, right?
But
know
there's also the other way, Dance, as well, isn't there? When things aren't going well with a team and you've got to effectively grill the manager as well. That's especially when you've got a close relationship with them and you know, you respect them and you're expected to go in there and say, do you fear for your job now? That kind of stuff, which, you know, I've had to ask that question a few times. Really got to put your head above the parapet in that sense.
I was just having a conversation, funny enough, with Tony Pulis the other day about that and sort of relationships that he'd had with people that had worked on his patch and that thing that, and I'd agree with him because I remember dealing with, you know, Tony when, you know, as the interviewer and when he was the manager, that I think he recognised that the journalists had a job to do. Mm. I think particularly on a patch, they were incredibly useful to you and actually was ready to take some robust questioning because appreciates that the journalist is doing their job. I think would also see that the fans, you know, then realise that he is fronting up and answering the questions and actually, yeah, and you know, it's that acceptance, isn't it, that both sides recognise the job that each has to do. And it doesn't always work. We know it doesn't always work because we've, you know, had experiences where it's certainly not worked. But
well, I wish David Pleat would have understood it that way when I interviewed him once in my very, very early days. I'll never forget it. They'd just been walloped 5-0 by Manchester United the previous week. And I forget who they were playing the next week. So we're doing the press conference and it was in the reception for some reason at Hillsborough. And I said and it was something really innocuous. Don't forget, I was probably 22, something like that. So still kind of finding my way. And I just said, you know, you got beat 5-0 last weekend. Fans are getting disgruntled. Can you understand where they're coming from? And he just kind of blew up and said, and you'll know David Pleat, Ali, you'll know him really well. He's a lovely chap. Yeah. But back then,
I love working for him.
He just snapped and said, if I was a violent man, I'd punch you in the face for that question, but I'm not, so I won't. And then every other question was a one-word response. And I was working for Hallam FM at the time. He then phoned BBC Sheffield, assuming I worked for them, to apologise. He spoke to Burnsy, who then passed the apology on to me. And then I bumped into him at a game at Old Trafford not so long after, and he apologised again. So I thought, well, fair play. But on that one afternoon, I just thought, maybe this industry's not for me. It really knocked my confidence. And I kind of went out of the ground with my tail between my legs, leaving all the written guys just kind of looking in surprise, saying, what on earth just happened there?
Yeah.
So that was a scary experience, actually. Yeah.
I got coated by Ian Holloway, who you mentioned, Ali, before. Really? After the there was a Blackpool were at Villa and they lost. He'd made 10 changes. And Mick McCarthy had done the same thing for a Wolves game at Manchester United some time before, and the Premier League had fined Wolves.
Yeah.
So I gently broached that subject with Ian Holloway. So, you know, you made 10 changes tonight. Mick McCarthy was fined by the Premier League for it's got nothing to do with Wolves. You're an ass, and that's being disrespectful to donkeys or something. And off he goes, and suddenly he's become this wild from a happy-go-lucky, cheery, bouncy fella. He's turned into this terrier from absolutely nowhere. But no, he was having none of it. And I, even though I've been in the game, I mean, that's what, 10 years or so ago now. So I've been doing it for 10 years. That shocked me. And I've been around in you know, tunnels and press areas for an awfully long time. But that shook me, I have to tell you, when somebody like Ollie turns on you. But we did kiss and make up. And we did subsequently do an incredible game at Villa Park, a commentary Villa 5, Forest 5,
yeah,
in the Championship a few years ago, when Ollie was describing Jack Grealish as like sitting in front of a warm fire drinking Baileys over ice. Now, you two might be able to make sense of that.
Yeah, well, I know where he's coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
And when, of course, when the score was 5-4, he was going in my ear, he's 5-4, 4-5. He found that magical scoreline. And then when Lewis Graben makes it 5-5, he's talking about 5-5, it's that Disney mouse. It's that Disney mouse. And I'd never seen 5-5, this Disney cartoon about a mouse. So I had no idea what he's going on about. But that's Ollie's brilliance. It's the non sequiturs, isn't it? It can just come from absolutely nowhere. Right, let's change tack for a moment. Ali, not just football, but you do golf commentary as well. You've been lucky enough not just to go to, you know, World Cups and European Championships, but I have to admit, a bit of the green-eyed monster that you've covered Ryder Cups and Open Championships. Just talk me through the dynamic of what it's like to commentate on golf as opposed to football.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy doing it, Dan. A, because I love the sport, but B, because it's such a different, not discipline in a way, because you're still describing sporting action that's going on in front of you, but it's such a different rhythm and pace and vocabulary and everything. And actually, what I would say about doing the golf is I don't think in any sport that you get closer to the action than we do on the golf course. So, you know, at the Ryder Cup, in certain positions, what they'll say to you before the start of the week is, you know, you get your radio bib on and they'll say, if you're wearing that bib, you are not allowed to move more than an arm length away from the ropes kind of either side of the course. And that's sort of that's the rule, but it's not set in stone, because at certain points in the course, you just cannot, you can't operate that, because you can't actually see what's going on if you do that. And so there's a little bit of give and take. And the other thing I think you've got to be really aware of when you do it is you have got this incredible view to commentate on the action, but also you've got paying spectators, particularly at something like the Ryder Cup, who aren't going to see that much golf during the day, who've stood in a certain point for 3.5 hours to watch this little bit of action. And if you get in the way of them seeing that little bit of action, then you are for it. You really are for it. So it's a good idea to sort of do the old stretching exercises before you get out there, because there's a lot of sort of crouching and lying and bending yourself into position to do the commentary. But it's great. And I think the thing particularly about the Ryder Cup, Dan, so I think I would class my favourite day of work ever, all time, as the final day of the Ryder Cup at Medina in 2012, where Europe were dead and buried. And then it was the incredible comeback and, you know, Kaimer's putt, and they won it on the final green. And I think part of the reason for that, from my point of view, is that the Ryder Cup is the golfing equivalent of the World Cup final. Mm. And because of my play, I mean, I get to do some amazing football games for Radio 5 Live, don't get me wrong. But we have a football correspondent in John Murray. We've got a senior football reporter in Ian Dennis. So those two did the last World Cup final and, you know, do England, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't quite get to do that very, very top echelon of the sport that I, you know, cover the most. The Ryder Cup, though, is that. It is that event. And in terms of an atmosphere and what's riding on it, it is incredible. It is absolutely incredible. Funny enough, on social media, I saw shots of the... we're in Italy later this year for the Ryder Cup. And the first tee has become a real thing in the last decade or so. And particularly because we're in Italy, they basically, the stand they are building around the first tee, it's like the blooming Colosseum. Honestly, the atmosphere on there is just going to be absolutely bonkers. So it's an incredible, and, you know, first and foremost, it's because I love the sport. I absolutely love the sport. I play golf. I've always watched golf. I'm a bit of a golf nerd about the history of the sport. So I love it for that reason. But it's also got that sort of test match special vibe to it, our coverage. You're right, it's just very different for the football.
Have you ever been shushed? Because, of course, you do have to keep your voice very, very low at important points.
Yes, I have. Scary one at the Ryder Cup actually was Sam Torrance, who was a vice captain, who felt I was talking too loudly and gave me he was right behind me, actually, and gave me a tap on the shoulder and a point, just a point. And look, honestly, it was awful, absolutely awful. But because you got the headphones on, when everything goes from bedlam to quiet, you then don't quite realize how far your voice carries when it's total silence, even though you think you're speaking quietly. And actually, that's where our summarizers, our expert summarizers, are really good with us, because they will get you, because they've played the game, they know what it's like to have a commentator on course. So they'll put you in exactly the right spot, and they'll say, if you stand here with downwind, so the wind is going to carry your voice, so better get your clipboard up in front of your mic so that sort of blocks. Some brilliant little tips like that. But yes, the one you didn't want to get on the wrong end of, and you're going to guess it, is Monty. Monty could hear the old butterfly wings fluttering from, 200 yards if it wasn't going well. And luckily, I never disturbed him. So that was
how easy is it, Ali, to keep sight of the ball? I mean, having never done a golf commentary, it's only a little white thing, obviously.
Yeah.
When a player hits a shot to 300 yards, how do you know where it's landed?
So actually, Paul, the funny thing with that is that most of the commentary, if you listen to our coverage, I mean, that's the other fascinating thing about golf coverage, is we'll be on air for sort of 10 hours of a Ryder Cup day. If you actually distilled the amount of golf we actually described during that time, it would be quite a small percentage of airtime. And actually what we end up doing is a lot of putts, commentating on a lot of putts, because putts obviously are the business end and the crucial thing. And so quite often what you'll do is, Mark Chapman, the presenter, will say, Alistair Bruce Ball is with Rory McIlroy on the fourth. And I'll be walking down the fairway and I'll say, yes, he's hit his drive to 300 yards. This is what he's got left. Get a view from the expert summarizer. But the actual sort of commentary on the shot isn't until we get closer to the green, when you can then see everything and see the ball and whatever. Mm. And one of the greatest tips I've ever learned, and it's not just for golf, and for any commentators, aspiring commentators listening out there now, scribble this down. Very early Open Championship I went to, Tony Adamson used to be the BBC's golf correspondent, and he was about to head out on course to do some commentary. And I had a little look at his clipboard and what he had down on it. And in one column, he had a list of maybe it was probably about 30 different ways to describe a golf ball rolling towards a hole. So 30 different verbs, because it's the same thing. I mean, it's a bit like football. When a player hits a shot, it's the same thing every single time. And so he would tick a word off once he'd used it. It's just such a, such a brilliant, simple idea, but just key.
Yeah, that's clever. That's very clever. You're right about the fact that it becomes a sport where you can't get to the higher echelons of commentating on football for your employer, but to get to the highest echelons of commentating on another sport, I'd never really thought about it that way. Maybe I should think that way about my darts commentaries. Actually, I had to get to commentate on the World Championship final in a sport. I should be a bit more grateful, really, thinking about it. Paul, what other sports have you done, if any, other than football? I mean, you mentioned ice hockey with the Euro back in the day, but is there anything you've turned your hand to in recent years?
Boxing. I did boxing for a time at BBC Sheffield. I don't think I did that particularly well. That's hard as well. You don't realise how hard boxing is, trying to pick out the right shots, the ones that land, the point scoring blows, if you like. That's quite difficult. But I did a few Clinton Woods fights, and we went over to Florida, I think it was. Tampa. Yeah, went over to Tampa when he fought Antonio Tarver. And for BBC Sheffield, that was a big deal, following a boxer overseas like that was a big expense for the station. But credit to them for backing him. But sadly, he lost. But fabulous experience to be out there with him. Ice hockey, as you mentioned, didn't do that particularly well. Basketball as well. Goodness me, that's hard. That is hard. Cricket, I've never given a go at. I've done a few cricket reports in my time, but cricket, don't know whether I could do that. I've always fancied doing golf, though. I've watched golf on TV, and I think, wouldn't mind a bit of that. And obviously, the places you go with the golf as well, all around the globe. I mean, well, Ali, I'm very jealous. You get to go to some lovely locations.
Well, Ali will know a friend of mine who used to work at TalkSport, Richard Kaufman, who a Fulham season ticket holder, but he is part of the Pro Tour, and he is in these exotic locations that you speak of, Paul, more often than not. He is somebody who is genuinely on the other side of the world most of the year and watching golf, although some of the severe weather that comes along can't be that much fun to report in. Ali, I bet you've been caught in some freak weather whilst you've been doing Open Championships or Ryder Cups.
Yeah, the one day I wasn't involved, funny enough, and I can't remember why I wasn't there. It might have been just after the birth of my first child. And I think it was the one Open Championship I didn't work at, but obviously I wasn't going to miss a beat. So, BBC had full coverage on the television there, so I had my television on and my radio on, and I switched it on that first Thursday morning, and the weather was absolutely horrific. And because you've been there and you've been in that, I mean, I think John Inverdale was presenting the coverage at the time, and they were rushing out sort of spare pairs of socks to him and all sorts. I mean, it was one of those days you had all the layers on, you had the waterproofs on, but if you're out there for that length of time, you get properly soaked. But I think the quite nice thing about that is you're all in it together. And actually, it's one of those things that comes across, I think, on air. I think that's the great thing. I mean, that's what we're always trying to do, particularly on radio coverage, isn't it, is put the listeners in our shoes and exactly what it's like. And certainly that day I was listening, I wasn't working, but I knew exactly what that was like. And you listen to the likes, you know, John Murray and Ian Carter describing, you know, that sort of torture, but at the same time realizing that they're at one of the greatest sporting events in the world, so you can't grumble about it.
No. You take the rough with the smooth, and no matter where it is, if it's something as seismic as the Ryder Cup, Paul, let me turn back to you, because as I mentioned in my introduction to you, you're now a regular commentator on championship matches which go around the world, but also they get heard on the ITV4 highlights package that they've now secured from Quest. How did that role come? Did you leave Radio Sheffield for that role?
No. You'll remember the BBC got the rights to start with when Manish used to present the show.
Oh, yes, with Steve Claridge. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Leroy Senior as well. I got into the Football League show back then. Mark Clement, who you'll know, was doing some stuff for them, and I just got chatting to him, and he said, "Oh, I think they might be looking for a VO guy, you know, rounding up the goals on the packages." So I got in touch with a chap called Charlie Bolshin, and sent him a demo down, saying, "Look, if there's ever an opportunity to come and have a go, I work for the BBC. I think they'll be willing to release me from my Saturday duties. Then give me a shout." And he did. And I had a very understanding boss at BBC Sheffield at the time, and I said, "Look, they've asked me to go down on a regular basis and they like my voice. They want me to voice the League One and League Two packages for them. How do you feel about that?" He said, "Yeah, it's good for us. It reflects well on us because you're our guy and you're now a national telly. Go and do it." So I went down there. And at that point, the championship goals packages, I'm not talking about the commentary now, I'm talking about the goals roundups. The championship was done from BT Tower. League One and League Two was done from a place in Beaconsfield, I believe it was, called Arkiva, which they also used to do the national lottery from. They may well still do it from there. So the voice of the balls was down one end of the corridor to where we were working. So one of us was rounding up Gillingham against MK Dons, whilst the voice of the balls is reading out the numbers on the national lottery. Which
well,
was
you were
bizarre.
The voice of the balls too, just the voice well, of the
well, exactly,
different
yeah.
shape balls.
Exactly. And I never forget, they came round the office one day. They needed somebody to pick the machine for that night's draw, right? So the rest of the guys in the office had already done it. So they said, "Paul, you're up. You can do it." So I picked out Excalibur or whatever it was and set of balls number four and didn't think anything else of it. They gave me a tea towel and a cup and a pen and maybe a key ring. And then my phone went absolutely bananas just after the draw, saying, "They've just mentioned you, I'm sure, on the lottery, having picked the balls out. Was that you?" And I'm getting all these messages from everywhere. I've never been so popular. I said, "Yeah, it was me. So for all of my broadcasting work, I've never really been noted for that. But the one time I pick out the machine to do the national lottery draw is the time that I really, really made it. So that was interesting. Yeah. So I started doing the voiceovers, and then occasionally they'd send me out to do a commentary. And it just be, you know, it's like everything else. You do something once, if you do it reasonably well, there's a chance they'll get you back to do it. So I'd slowly moved away from the voiceover side of things to do the main match, and then became quite regular doing that. And it left the BBC, it went to Channel 5, then Quest, and now ITV. And fortunately, I've been able to hang on by my fingernails doing that. So that's how the BBC thing kind of started and moved and ended up where we are now on ITV. But, you know, it's something I enjoy. I love the championship for its drama anyway. I'm not just saying that because I cover it. The Premier League I enjoy, but you kind of know what's going to happen in the Premier League, what teams are going to be up there. But with a championship, you really have no clue. It really is one of the best leagues around the world, I think. So much drama, apart from Saturday where I was doing Preston Cardiff, which was blooming awful. And you get that from time to time, but no, it's great. And I've been lucky enough since going freelance in 2014 to do other stuff, working at BT, doing French games and Bundesliga and all manner of leagues. I even did Chinese Super League at one stage for the World Feed out of London. That is the hardest thing I've ever had to do. I've Whoa. Never been so relieved to put a mic down at the end of the game, having had done a Chinese Super League game. That was really, really testing. Not just because of the names, there was limited information, but the directors over in China just do not operate like directors do here. So a player can be running through on goal and they'll suddenly pan to somebody in the crowd.
Oh, God.
But I never forget, I think Guangzhou Evergrande were playing and I think Hulk ran through to score. He did score and the camera guy zooms right in on Hulk as he celebrates and stays on him for what felt like forever. So, of course, you're giving it big licks. Hulk scores, blah, blah, blah. And by the time we got the wide shot again, the referee is doing the VAR sign, not for the first time, but for the second time. So whilst I've been talking about Hulk having scored, they've gone to VAR, which I've not seen, never even knew they were going to VAR. Comes back to the wide shot and the referee's doing the thing. He's doing the square with his fingers and saying goal disallowed. And it's like, what on earth was that all about? So I was made to look a bit of a fool there, to be fair. So that can happen when you're doing off-tube stuff, as I'm sure you both have done.
Yes.
I think the lesson is, and unless you're absolutely sure, don't commit, because you just do not know what the director's doing in his head.
It's funny you say that, though, Paul. I mean, I come at that from a slightly different angle, because I talking about the sort of radio reporting on a Saturday afternoon. Mm. So obviously, if you were listening to talk or us on a Saturday afternoon, commentary game plus reporters at the other games,
yep.
You know, get to the goals as quick as you can, bang, 15 seconds back to the commentary. Let's not miss anything, bounce it all around. And so quite often, you know, if you're the reporter at a game, you've got a buzz as soon as the ball hits the back of the net, unless you couch every single report you do with this goal might not stand because of VAR, you've pretty much, I think, got to give the goal. And then quite often, I mean, it's happened in the last few seasons, quite often you have to come back to the reporter who says, sorry, no, that goal's been ruled out. But that's the way football works now. It's just kind of, you've got to go with it.
I did a Saturday afternoon shift in for Adrian for that round the grounds format. And we have our little phrase, goals as they go in. And by 10 past four, I was saying goals as they're ruled out on Talk Sports. It just seemed to make more sense because there were three or four examples that have, you know, of VAR.
I'm glad I don't have to deal with that on a weekly basis, if I'm brutally honest. Obviously, in the Championship, we don't have it. So, it's quite a bonus, really.
You on that.
Just another name you mentioned there, actually, Paul. It's so funny, isn't it? I mean, you know, so many names we've dropped in today are people that, you know, are mutual acquaintances or whatever. Manish Basin, he and I were on the same journalism course together all the years ago in Cardiff. Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert, was also on the same course. And I got a phone call from him about, I can't remember, maybe 7-8 years after we'd left, you know, and graduated and all gone our separate ways. And he asked me to be one of his phone-a-friends on Celebrity Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in case a sports question came up, because he was the only,
fabulous.
I was the only sports person he could think of who might have a chance. And I obviously said, yes, I will do that, but terrified that it would be, you know, A, for an awful lot of money, and B, one of those awful 50-50s where you think you know it, but you're not entirely sure. And then your entire reputation just goes down the pan on national television. And it's so funny because, you know, you go through the whole rigmarole. So the program phones you and says, are you ready? Are you sitting by a phone? You can't have any devices on. And then so me and my wife sat there over dinner. Is it going to ring? Is it going to ring? Phone never rang. It was never needed. So.
Got it. Yeah, yeah.
What a letdown. Yeah. Well, so we've had the lottery and millionaire in this episode of Commentator's Curse. We'll have Michael McIntyre's Big Show next time, or something like that. How much notice, Paul, do you get for the Championship commentaries that you do? I get asked this a lot about how much notice I get. Sometimes it's a week, sometimes it's a month, sometimes it's 2 months. It's movable feast.
Yeah, it's roughly a month in advance. So, you know, the way that football works, you know, you might get a game at the start. You might get your list of games at the start of a month and you'll look at a fixture and go, that'll be great. That'll be a great one to do. But by the time you get to it, both clubs might have had a severe drop in form and it becomes a mid-table clash, which is a hard sell. But it's usually a month in advance. So I know where I'm going this weekend, the following weekend, right up to the end of March.
Right.
Now, and partly into April. And, you know, I get asked the question a lot, who picks the games? Is it the TV? No, it's not. It's the EFL. The EFL decide which games are going to be distributed for worldwide broadcast. So I can put that out there now, because that is a question I get asked a lot. Who's picking these games? It's the EFL. Right. And I think, you know, they and I understand it, they want to get around as many clubs as possible. I suppose from my point of view, I would like to see somebody have more of an editorial input when we come towards the business end of the season.
Yes.
And that's no kind of slight on people making the decisions, but from a viewer's point of view, to me, it would make more sense to go and follow where the story is. And that sometimes doesn't quite happen in the way that I would want it to.
There's no kind of minimum game requirement.
I don't know. Dance, I don't know.
Like there is with Sky, because Sky have to show each Premier League team at least twice before Christmas or something.
It could well come down to that. And again, there's got to be an equal spread. But I suppose with my editorial hat on, sometimes I'm sat at a ground thinking, I'm not sure we should be at this one today. I think we should be elsewhere, but you know, I think that.
Well, clearly, Preston Cardiff didn't fire your enthusiasm.
It wasn't great. Let's be honest. In fact, the first half, I can comfortably say, is possibly the worst half of football I've ever seen in my broadcasting career. It really was that bad. But in the end, a big result for Preston.
So. Yes, and they're as usual on the fringes of the playoffs. It seems to be the perennial thing for Preston to be kind of on the edges of it, but never quite getting in there. But actually, Millwall, who are kind of much like Preston, actually might, for a change, get involved in the postseason jamboree. It's been a while since
they normally tail off, don't they, Millwall? Yes. But he seems to have got a good thing going there, Gary. I like him. I would not fancy playing them in the playoffs. I wouldn't fancy playing Middlesbrough, actually. I'm just hoping the Sheffield United can keep them at arm's length. But who knows? By the time we next play, the gap might be just a point. So
that's very true.
Third, so I'm hoping that isn't the case, but there you go.
And the other side of Sheffield Wednesday with this ridiculous unbeaten run that they're on, it's magnificent for the city. I was chatting with Andy Giddings, your former colleague, about this last week, about how the city must be feeling about it all, given that there's a double promotion on the cards. And of course, for BBC Radio Sheffield, the chance for Chesterfield to get up, you know, the chance for Doncaster to get involved in the playoffs. There's all sorts of... And Barnsley.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I do miss working at BBC Sheffield, because the patch is an excellent one. Very passionate footballing city, but not just the football. You know, you've got other sports, the ice hockey, basketball, rugby league. There's always something going on. And that was something I really enjoy. You know, doing the Steel City derbies were fantastic. The build-up to them all, the banter, the fallout, the stories... You know, I covered countless Sheffield derbies. In fact, on one occasion, we had fans commentary on digital radio. I got two fans together, which was taking a bit of a risk, but worked out really well. So we were able to use some of that at halftime and at full time on air. So I enjoyed coming up with ideas like that. Chesterfield, you know, when they played Middlesbrough in the Cup semi-final, that's still one of the best games I've been at. And Sheffield United 4, Forest 3 in the playoffs. That will take some beating for me. That was just an incredible game at Bramall Lane. Looking across at the guys, my colleagues from BBC Nottingham, Colin Frey and Robin Chipperfield, looking at them thinking, yeah, jammy beggars, you're off to the final. And then it all changed in the second half. It was just sensational. But the outcome, as it usually is with Sheffield United, they lost in the playoff final. They always lose in the playoff final. So that's another reason, Dance, why they need to get it done automatically this year, because they just do not do playoff finals, plain and simple.
Well, I wasn't a Jonah for you last week going down to watch them play Reds.
No, so no.
You can be grateful to me for that, I'm sure.
But we lost at home at the weekend.
Well, that's very true. That's very true.
Not good.
Ali, forging partners, because Paul works alone doing his EFL commentaries. You predominantly work with Chris Sutton, who you now do the FPL with. And I remember meeting you two guys at a baggage reclaim place in Russia, I think Rostov or something like that, when your relationship was in its infancy. But you could see then the playfulness with which you were dealing with one another, which fed in, not self-indulgently, I must say, into the way you you approached your commentaries?
Yeah, it's again sort of happy accident in a way, Dan. So for Russia, because of the distances that we had to cover, they basically for the first time. So normally at a World Cup, as people will probably know on Five Live, you would take a certain number of commentators, a certain number of pundits, and then you'd hear various commentators with various pundits, and we'd move around, you know, whichever country you're in, say Germany in 2006 or South Africa in, you know, in 2010, and you'd hear a sort of mix of commentators and pundits. This time they decided to keep us together for the entire roster of games. So I think Chris and I might have done 10 games together, traveled everywhere together. So there was me, Chris, our producer, Juliet Farrington, who's an absolute star, and then a Russian woman with us as well, a girl called Ksenia, who was there to kind of, you know, help facilitate things and
fix her.
You know, a fixer, exactly, a fixer. And it just worked brilliantly, certainly from my point of view, Dan, because I remember meeting Chris at Heathrow over a coffee. I'd worked with him once before, listened to him a lot. We've got the sort of Ipswich Norwich thing going on in a site, you know, slightly kind of playful way. So there's a bit of knockabout there. But what I love about Chris is a lot of, as you say, a lot of playfulness, tongue in cheek a lot of the time. And I think people who get wound up by him don't realize that tongue is firmly planted in cheek a lot of the time. Incredibly sharp. You know, get into any sort of footballing debate with him and you better be prepared. You better be, you know, have your wits about you because he is razor sharp. And I think really enjoys the entertainment side of it. And I think to me that is what I love about the job we do, is that, you know, it's important to a certain extent because people really care about their football, but we are there, you know, football is meant to be entertainment, and Chris likes to have fun with it. And so one of the things that again just happened by fluke in Russia was we were sitting in the bus one day chatting to Ksenia, and one of us said something like, that's put the cat amongst the pigeons. And she said, what on earth does that mean? That's put the cat. So we got into the, you know, a conversation about what that meant. And she said, oh, in Russia, that you would say, that's let the goat into the vegetable garden. So the entire theme of our commentaries for the rest of the trip was trying to get these Russian aphorisms, as many as we could, into our commentaries. There was another one, which Chris threw at Mark Chapman, where apparently in Russia, I think if you, like, if someone says, are you winding me up? It's, are you hanging noodles from my ears? So at the opening, brilliant, to one of the shows we did, sort of Chappers came on air and presented it. And Chris, within about a minute, went, oh, come on, Chappers, you're hanging noodles from my ears there, mate, like that. Chappers didn't have a clue what was going on. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I absolutely love working with Chris. I think he's brilliant. And the other thing, very quickly, Dan, that really struck me about him, and I think we'd all say the same about, you know, all the summarizers we work with, but this, I saw this at close hand, is Chris's prep for a game and prep for a show really, really impressed me on that trip. So we would sit down at breakfast on the morning of a game, and, you know, it was almost like an hour's meeting together where we both get our notes out and what do you think of this squad? How are they going to play? If you go down this line, what line will I go down? But the amount of work that goes into a commentary or a show for Chris, it really, and I'm sure it's the same. It's not, you know, it wouldn't just be Chris. I'm not sort of, you know, holding him apart from other summarizers, but it really impressed me on that trip.
I had exactly the same relationship in that World Cup with Matt Holland. He was my co-commentator throughout. We did the same games together, and Matt is as meticulous as Chris is. And as you say, there's a list as long as your arm of pundits who put the hard yards in and do the prep. Sometimes not as neatly as others. I look at Perry Groves' pieces of paper that he writes down, and it looks like, you know, it's just indecipherable. It's hieroglyphics. I can't make out head nor tail of what he's written. But it's all good stuff, and it's all there ready to be utilised at a moment's notice. And, yeah, it makes our job as a commentator that much easier. And I'm sure you work with pundits from time to time as well, Paul, even in the where, you know, they can take the load off a little bit.
Most recently I worked with Dean Ashton at the Carabao Cup final, and I've worked with Dean a few times. He's a top bloke. I do like working with Dean.
He's lovely.
Reads the game very well, but it makes such a difference when you get on with the person off mic as well. And I'd like to think that Dean and I do that. And there are others, Michael Brown, obviously I know from a Sheffield United days, he, you know, I've done countless games with him. you know, there are people who you get to know in this business who do become friends who you end up working with. And, you know, Stuart Robson, you mentioned earlier on, I've worked with Stuart as well. He's always very well prepped, very, very good to work alongside. And if you've got that rapport with somebody, then it makes such a difference. But you are right. I do miss working with somebody else alongside me on a week-to-week basis because, as you said earlier, I am on my own. And there are some afternoons where you're thinking, goodness me, I've used all my notes. I've said everything I can possibly say about this game, but literally nothing else is happening. I would love just 10 seconds to kind of reset, regather my thoughts and bring someone else in, but I can't do that.
No.
So that for me, I do miss. And, the kind of day-to-day office-based stuff when I was sports head in Sheffield, I miss that. So you are a lone wolf. And as exciting as this industry is sometimes, it's a lonely old business as well when you're self-employed and you're trying to make a quick buck here and there. So it's not all it's cracked up to be all of the time.
Frankly, services at stupid o'clock in the morning.
Well, exactly, mate.
It can be a reality check. Some of those service stations on your way home.
Or being taken through Daventry in the 2 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to get north and you've got a half hour diversion or more. You know, it's all good fun.
We all love the highways agency, don't we? I think we'll leave it there, gents, but we've chatted for well over an hour. It's been fantastic company having you both with me on this episode. Paul, I don't know whether you're going to be at the Sheffield United quarterfinal on
I am planning to be there as a supporter dance.
I see. Well, I might well see
you
there.
Got to use my contacts and go down, I think.
Oh, you're going there, are you, Ali?
I'll see you there.
Oh, marvellous. Oh, well, that's our week. We might all meet up and have a...
Mind you, it is Mother's Day, isn't it?
It is, but my mother's already sorted out a lunch at her old tennis club. So she says, I don't need you on Sunday. I'm already sorted. So
that's a good pass out then.
Thanks, Mum. So I'll go and see her on Monday instead, perhaps something like that. Ali, Paul, thank you so much for being on this
pleasure.
Episode
thank
of the
you.
Commentators. It's been cheers, brilliant having you both on.
Top man. See you both soon, yeah?
Yeah, we'll do.
So my thanks to Alistair Bruce Ball and Paul Walker for joining me on this episode of The Commentator's Curse. If you've enjoyed it and this is your first experience of this podcast, there's another 20 episodes that you can delve into wherever you found this particular edition, going right the way back to episode 1 with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker, who were my first guests. So hope you can join me for the next time on The Commentator's Curse. Ian Danter signing off.